It's our generation or our parents' generation which became consumers. And before the Second World War, people in the past didn't have things. They were modest. They were thrifty. They were virtuous. Consumption didn't really matter to them. Many commentators who continue to moralize consumption have this idea in their head that inequality is behind consumption, and that if we were more equal societies, then consumption would slow down. Well, this graph proves the opposite. What consumption ultimately is about is what we can call normalization. So how something that was unusual or exotic, like coffee, tea, and so forth, becomes normalized.
Diese Stimme gehört Frank Trentmann. Frank Trentmann ist Historiker, Autor und Professor für Geschichte am Birkbeck College of London. Sein preisgekröntes Buch Herrschaft der Dinge erzählt die Geschichte des Konsums von der Renaissance bis heute. Für uns am AHA-Festival 2022 hat er die Frage beantwortet, wie wurden wir zu KonsumentInnen? Den Vortrag, den ihr gleich hört, hielt Frank Trentmann im Januar 2022 im Südpol in Luzern. Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
Thank you very much, Herr Fellmann. Grüezi Sie wohl in Luzern. As I said to Herr Fellmann, I very much had looked forward to joining you in person, but for obvious pandemic reasons, that was unfortunately not possible. Nonetheless, I think we owe a great thanks to the organizers for having rescheduled and seen through the festival. So how did we become a world of consumers? What I'd like to do is to start with a very recent present, because I think the pandemic and what the pandemic did to consumption highlights why it is important to think about the longer history of consumption to help us think about the future of our lives. Now, these two pictures capture where a lot of Europe was in April 2020, so just almost 2 years ago. And in the top left, you have a picture taken at the Vittorio Emanuele II Galleria, the old grand 19th century shopping mall arcade in Milan, which you can see is completely empty, except for one shop assistant who stands guard outside her shop. On the same day, in Wolfsburg, northern Germany, the home of Volkswagen, VW, the producer VW decided their approach is going to be hochfahren, to reboot the economy as quickly as possible to get back to the level of production and consumption that we had become accustomed to in the years before COVID. If you look back at the spring of 2020, you can see sort of three grand forecasts or prognoses that made the rounds. The first was the pandemic will crash the system. Capitalism will collapse. We're going to die of disease, hunger, and starvation, a kind of biblical forecast. The second was really cheerful. The pandemic will teach you. We don't need all this stuff. We can adopt simple living and all be happy and save the planet. And then there was a third prognosis, which the central bankers and economists liked, which was, this isn't that serious. It's really more like a cut in a film, which can be easily repaired and glued together, and we will continue exactly as before. So these are three prognoses, and I'd like to suggest that all three of them were fundamentally wrong, And one reason why they are wrong was that they misunderstood the history of consumption and misunderstood why we consume the way we do and why we consume as much as we do. And that's what I like to talk to you about today and take you through is the longer history. And ultimately, it's a very simple, I think, mental step because yesterday was at some stage also the future. So literally, the history of consumption is an ongoing laboratory of changing norms and ideals and practices of consumption. And we can learn a lot about our present and our prospects in the future by following how certain things which were once unknown or exceptional became normal. So how the new normal was once the old normal. Let me take you back in time to the early modern period, so before the Industrial Revolution, and I've picked out sort of four items, highly desirable possessions, which illustrate some of the main drivers of consumption. The people who believe we should go back to simple living often look at the post-war years, so after 1945, the economic miracle, the Wirtschaftswunder, or the Trente Glorieuse, as a rupture, a break. And the idea here is that really it's our generation or our parents' generation which became consumers. And before the Second World War, people in the past didn't have things. They were modest. They were thrifty. They were virtuous. Consumption didn't really matter to them. This is a great myth that underlies a lot of commentary. You can see it in the newspapers almost every day, but it gets fundamentally wrong the story of consumption, which is long and deep. So if we just look at the top right, we have a so-called majolica plate. So majolica is a form of glazing that was perfected in Renaissance Italy. This plate comes from Urbino and has a beautiful forest scene on it. And this one plate comes from a service of an elite family, which had over 100 pieces of plates and 100 cups and so forth. Now, you could argue, well, that's sort of an elite household. So let's look at the top left, which is a porcelain bottle from late Ming China. It comes from an area called Yingdeshen. And Yingdeshen was an area which had thousands of kilns producing many hundred thousands of these bottles every year. And we know we have these bottles. You can find them almost in every half-decent museum because they were so widespread that they literally were ubiquitous. So you can find items like this in funeral grounds of modest farmers, artisans. So this is not an elite item at all. If you look very closely, you can see what's distinctive is that in addition to the glazing, you have this lovely blue color, and it's a scene of a servant approaching a scribe, a calligrapher, sitting at a table surrounded by flowers. Now, no one in Europe could produce anything similar to this item in its fineness, in its beautiful coloring, and importantly, in its sturdiness. Because one thing that set porcelain apart, in addition to being pretty, was that it was smooth to the touch and it could keep heat. And this is important because we see in the early modern period a dramatic expansion in demand for exotic beverages. So hot tea, coffee, chocolate. Europeans had earthenware products that were far rougher and would crack. Now, this set Europeans off to a very competitive game of trying to discover the patent for porcelain, Many princes and dukes went bankrupt in that surge, and many manufacturers tried to imitate porcelain by coming up with substitute materials that were at least a look-alike version of porcelain. And Wedgwood, a British manufacturer, known across the world for his teapots still today, was one of the leading imitators and emulators. And you see at the bottom left what was called a jasperware. This is not porcelain. This is sort of a stoneware. But as you can see, what Wedgwood and his workers managed to do was have an alternative way of decorating his teapots by adding colored material to it. So this is not glazed, polished paint. Nonetheless, it is a rival that can take on competition. So that we don't forget it, Latin America also sees an expansion of consumption, but there it is a tea from a holly called mate, or mate, some people say, a holly which migrates from Central America to, is taken to Latin America and becomes the most popular beverage there. And you can you see here a very precious item of a silver cup with a so-called bombilla or straw at the bottom, which was shared by people drinking this tea. Now, what's interesting about all these four objects is that these are not items of individual self-gratification. They are forms of sociable consumption. Think of the tea party or people going to a coffee house to sit together and talk while drinking a coffee, or sharing the straw at a party drinking this matcha tea, or having dinner with friends and family. So this sociability is absolutely crucial, because you can imagine these items not by themselves, but by sponsoring and prompting other additional forms of consumption that require comfort. At the tea party, you don't want to sit on the floor. You may want to sit on a sofa or on an upholstered armchair. Again, innovations of the early modern period. And you don't want to be cold, so you will have nice curtains. And you don't want to stare at a blank white wall, so you have wallpaper. And many other items of domestic comfort, of the interior, of home consumption, that take off in this period. Now, to perhaps point out just how widespread this new style of consumption of drinking tea and coffee is, in the 18th century, in Amsterdam and London, it's artisans and workers who take it for granted that they can drink coffee or hot tea, and they have their own utensils to do so. And we can chart the explosion of these items, because at the point of death, people take inventories, and you can see the radical expansion and multiplication of possessions on consumer goods in households, first in Britain and Holland, but then also in neighboring countries in the 18th century. Now, what's interesting, in addition to them being sociable, is that many of these items are exotic. So their value derives from them coming from far and distant places. So these items we take for granted today initially were novelties, as people called them. And this is something where European forms of consumption now break with Asian consumer culture, because the emphasis now is on things being new. New is good, or new is best. Whereas in late Ming China, and you can see it in the porcelain vase, the point of reference remains antiquity. So a scribe perfecting the ancient art of calligraphy, for instance. In Britain and Holland, a new culture gets going, which is constantly in pursuit of new items, fashion. So the first fashion magazines take off, and which encourage consumers to aspire to constantly reinvent themselves through new clothes, new items, new wallpaper, and so forth. So the novelty is a new driver of demand. Coffee, I mentioned, tea, chocolate, we need to add sugar and tobacco. All of these are not domestic products. They come from overseas, and in particular, they come from colonial plantations. So it's important to recognize that consumption is not some, we tend to think of it as a market and it being about freedom of choice. At the time in the 17th and 18th and early 19th century, the circulation of these goods takes place in colonial contexts, and it's determined and shaped by imperial power. So without empires, the enslaved people from West Africa wouldn't have ended up in the West Indies to work on plantations to produce the sugar that is then consumed by consumers in Europe. So I think that's a very important reminder that politics and power really matters as much as markets and individual consumers. Now, by the late 19th century, we see a step up in what some people call mass consumption. And this coincides with modern nationalism in the years leading up to the First World War. And it has a very interesting effect because the exotic starts to disappear from goods like coffee and chocolate. And I've picked out a few of the advertisements which now start to get going. There's a revolution with the start of modern advertising in these years. And you can see in these various European images how formerly exotic colonial products are now taken out of their plantation context and they are given a nationalist makeover. So Cadbury's cocoa, the biggest chocolate manufacturer, will show you in adverts English pastoral scenes of a shepherd and a nice little English girl with a bonnet, or an English sailor who will tell you the real old English cocoa, as if cocoa grew in England. Of course, it doesn't. You see Jeanne d'Arc chocolate, named after the French national heroine. In Germany, you have Arminius coffee. Those of you who took Latin in school will now remember how often your Latin teacher reminded you that Arminius beat the Romans 9 after Christ's birth. And you can see him surrounded by oak trees. And these are oak trees. These are not coffee plantations. And my personal favorite from Finland, the so-called Paula girl, the biggest Finnish coffee manufacturer, Paulig company, after the First World War decides he wants to spread coffee and the habit of drinking coffee across all of Finland. So he has a beauty competition in which the most beautiful girl in Finland is chosen, the so-called Paula girl, who then for 1 year travels up and down Finland to show people how to make and drink Finnish coffee. The Paula girl is still in existence to this day. So what you have here is a makeover, a rebranding, where the origin of what we consume is effectively erased from the view of consumers in the affluent countries of Europe and North America. So we've had social and economic changes. We've had changes in the representation of goods, the importance of empire. But just as important, I would argue, is a mental revolution, a genuine intellectual sea change where people start to think differently about the relationship between goods, possessions, and the human self, who we are. And to illustrate that, perhaps it's good to remind us how negative the connotations of consumption and luxury were well into the early modern period. And I've taken a picture from an unknown Florentine artist on the bonfire of the vanities. A preacher, Savonarola, urged the citizens of Florence to adopt and rediscover a virtuous moral code, to focus on the things that are important, which are religion, praying, reading the Bible, going to church, and not to be distracted by frivolous fripperies such as paintings by Botticelli or luxurious carpets, books, musical instruments, anything that can be fun. And so the things were piled up in the Piazza della Signoria, in the heart, in the old heart of Florence, and set on fire. That is not unknown. You have in the German lands, and that includes parts of Switzerland like Basel, into the 18th century, you have scenes where women who are seen to sport exotic imported consumer goods, such as a fashionable Indian cotton scarf, for instance, being arrested by the police and thrown in prison or fined. The fines were sort of normally around a 1 month's salary for behaving indecently. These so-called sumptuary laws, or Kleiderordnung, which try to regulate and restrict consumption and control it, were widespread. And they were had legitimate authority. The great fear, not just by religious authorities, but also by the patriarchy, so masters in guilds and authorities in towns, but also thinkers and philosophers, was that goods, possessions, are ultimately evil. They threaten to corrupt the human soul and to distract us from the path of virtue. So they need to be checked and controlled. Otherwise, you give yourself over to a sinful life. So in that old paradigm, which you can trace back to Plato and to the early Christian fathers, the assumption is that really there is a self-contained human psychological self, which is in and of its own and lives apart from the world of things. So on the one side, we have the human, and then on the other side, we have stuff, the material world. This divide starts to be bridged and questioned in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And the questions come from a number of directions. They come from religious directions. So you have Protestant thinkers and scientists who make the point that, well, if the world is God's creature and God had planned the world and travelers and merchants find new products like nutmeg or coffee or sugar, then surely it must have been God's plan for people to enjoy these things. So if you stop people from putting their hands on stuff, you are violating and getting into the way of God's plan. Then you have social, economic, and political commentators who say, well, all this luxury, we might have our own individual opinions about whether it's good or bad, but for society, surely it has positive side effects. Because if people want constantly new stuff, it means they're inventors and their new businesses, and these new businesses employ more people. And we have a much more productive and competitive economy than if we just prohibited all this stuff. We would never change. We would never develop. So the idea of progress and consumption become linked. And Adam Smith, perhaps the greatest moral philosopher and economist in the 18th century, brings it to a point in 1776 and in his Wealth of Nations, where he says that consumption is the sole purpose of all production. So rather than seeing consumption as something wasteful or passive or evil, it's actually the driver. It makes people produce something. Seems sort of obvious to us today, you know, if people don't want something, a company will go bust. But in the 18th century, this was a mental breakthrough. And this mental reorientation reaches its peak in psychology and philosophy. And I've picked out for you just one quote from the father of psychology, William James, an American, who in one of his volumes discusses the nature of the self. And he says, well, you know, people have a psychological self and they also have a social self. So their children, their parents, their friends, those are part of their self. They're not exclusively external. We, through our lives, we absorb the emotions and we identify with them. But he says, there's something more than that. And he says, you know, a man's self is also the sum total of everything that he can call his own. His clothes, his house, his lands and horses, his yacht, his bank account. All of these matter. They're part of his material self, as he called it, which is a nice, I think, way to capture this idea that things are not outside the self. They're partly make us who we are. Now, you might say to, if we had William James here, we might ask him, well, how did you reach this conclusion? What do you have to show to support it? And one thing William James points out is that many of the possessions we have become so central to our identity and self-understanding that when we lose them, it feels like losing a bit of a finger or part of our body. So if you imagine, I hope it won't happen, but if you imagine after this lecture and the literary festival, you go home, and as you come down the road, you see your house in flames, everything destroyed. Now that's a shock, but most people would not just look at it and say, okay, this is a problem of so and so many hundred thousands of Swiss francs. They would quickly think, oh God, in the house I had the old rings my grandmother gave us, or there was my favorite chair. I always loved sitting in that chair. That will be gone forever. Many of us have favorite clothes that we feel just are right. They're part of us. This shirt or this blouse really becomes part of one's body. In fact, there are some philosophers who believe that clothes and skin are so close, and because 90% of what we feel is through our skin, that clothes are really, our favorite clothes become part of our personality. So we have a mental revolution now where things begin to be appreciated as something that helps us fulfill our identity, allow us to be who we want to be, explore different kinds of identity as well. And that, of course, means it's very hard to argue for any authority, be it a city or a state, to tell us, no, you can't consume this, you can't consume that, because we feel it really reaches into ourself. So we've had social, economic, and a cultural shift. Very briefly, there's also a political shift, which sometimes gets forgotten. Consumers are not the same as shoppers. It's, I think, important to recognize that consumers, the word itself, has had political appeal and been injected with ideological and political hopes that have fired political movements. To pick out two that matter, one is the cooperative movement, which works on the idea that consumers are not just isolated individuals, but they can join forces. And if they do that, they generate collective power. Now, you all know the Migros That's a cooperative, and so they're still around. But in the course of the 19th century, they really had emancipatory hopes and ideals. They thought they would free the individual from exploitative practices. And also, they believed they would teach citizens to work together, to learn to be part of a collective, and to become better consumers. So to develop good taste and discerning demand. And here you have a picture from one of the stores in England in 1899. Consumers also started to argue they're not just customers. So what they do doesn't start and finish in a shop, but it starts with the kind of taste and demand you have, and also what you do with the goods, and how you think about the consequences of your actions as a consumer. And so on the top right, you have an image from one of the early consumer leagues from New York City. The National Consumers League was a large-scale social movement before the First World War with branches in most American cities. And their goal was to root out sweatshops, child labor, underpaid workers who produced cheap clothes in their neighborhoods. And you have similar consumer leagues in European cities at the time. They have an international association, and their motto was, as consumers, because of our spending power, we have rights, but we also have duties. So consumers have duties as citizens to consume in a way that makes their society a better place. And of course, you can see similar boycott movements continuing all the way to the present. Those were movements organized by consumers, but the state is not just a passive bystander. The state discovers consumers as well, both in the First World War and the Second World War. Having to fight a total war means the state wants to have control over resources, and that means the state needs to work with consumers to regulate them. After the Second World War, the state's interest in consumption reaches a new level, because the state also starts to spend on the public, on its citizens, in ways that encourages consumption. Economists, or statisticians, I should say, have a category which they call public social spending, which is everything from child benefits, state pensions, state unemployment benefits, but also housing allowance, so social housing and things like that. And if you look at the share of public social spending as a share of GDP in the years since the 1950s, and you can see this in the graph, the fat line is the rich countries in the OECD. France is the one at the very top, won't surprise you. You can see a steady expansion of this public social spending. So from roughly 8% in the OECD, it climbs to 20%. Now, why does this matter? Well, imagine you are a recipient of this public social spending. So you are living in a flat, which is part of social housing. So you pay a very low rental fee, and you also receive child benefits and many other benefits. That is money that allows you to consume, which you wouldn't have otherwise in a free market. And it's the state and public social spending in these years which is vital in lifting an entire segment of the population onto the stage of consumption. Why does this matter? Well, in many ways, but one thing I would always stress is that many commentators who continue to moralize consumption have this idea in their head that inequality is behind consumption, and that if we were more equal societies, then consumption would slow down. Well, this graph proves the opposite, because in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, is the time when European societies have been more equal than ever before or since. And this is the period, as you well know, the 1960s and 70s, which saw an unprecedented boom in consumption. So think of all the automobiles, fridges, freezers, electrical appliances that people start buying in these years. These are years of equality. Now, to get us back to the present, very briefly, this longer history is important because it, first of all, is a reminder how deeply ingrained and embedded consumption is in our societies. So this is not something very recent, which we can just turn off. People have acquired habits of consumption over long periods of time. If we look at what COVID did to how people consume, most of it is not a break. We have very good time use series, so that records how many minutes people spend on stuff since the 1960s. And what you can see is a lot of what happened in COVID is just an amplification of what people had started to do increasingly in the years before COVID, such as spending more time on self-improvement, learning new musical instruments, and so forth. That just continues under COVID. The same about active leisure. You remember the stories of people buying yoga mats and rowing machines for their home. Well, active leisure, again, has been a trend that's been growing since the 1960s. The home, of course, has become a form of the new oikos, familiar to ancient historians. Everything we now do at home, it's the office, it's the restaurant, it's our home cinema and our gym. But again, if we look at time use, many of these are just trends that are reinforced, such as the end of the weekend. So the weekend was already starting to dissolve, even in countries like Germany. People started working more and longer on Saturdays. And you can see in this chart here, which recorded the active electronic devices switched on in households in the spring. And you can see there the increase on the weekend. So the weekend is now, you could well argue, is on its deathbed. The more hopeful people who believe this is a chance for simple living, or what some people call dematerialization. So the idea that we just stop buying stuff and we just enjoy experiences. Many people had studied the spread of computer technology, which in 2018 took up 4% of world energy consumption and produced 2% of greenhouse gases. And we have excellent studies by specialists from before COVID, which all assumed that the world is turning a corner. Things are, we're going to need less stuff because everyone now has a computer. Everyone has a laptop. People, households were saturated, they said. Well, if you look at what happened since the pandemic, is you can see this idea that things are saturated are just ahistorical. Families started buying more laptops. Children needed their laptops for school. Smartphones started expanding. So what we see with computing is effectively a rerun of what we saw in earlier periods in history with other aspects where saturation never happens. There's an evolution of taste, demand, and comfort, which always produces new levels. So where does this leave us? What does this history tell us about where we might be heading? Well, the first thing I would perhaps stress is that COVID has highlighted just how deep inequalities reach. Gender, age, race, but also education and jobs, and those inequalities will I think, do a lot in shaping future consumption. But the second is that many people have forgotten how much of our consumption is really routine. It's habitual. So it's not something where, because the pandemic happens, we sit down and reflect and think, oh, wouldn't it be better to consume this or that? Many habits are so embodied that they keep on almost by themselves, and we just keep continuing these habits unless society is reorganized to promote new habits. So where will we go? Will we go down the Milan route, where city centers will stand empty, shops, restaurants, leisure, entertainment in the centers will die down? Or will we go down the VW route, where we just power up and continue where we are? Well, I would suggest that both of these are extremes, and it's not necessarily helpful to think in these pure terms. What consumption ultimately is about is what we can call normalization. So how something that was unusual or exotic, like coffee, tea, and so forth, becomes normalized. And we forget just how recent these things were abnormal. This is not a natural process. It is shaped by politics, such as empires and states. And it's very important to realize that how we live today or how we lived 2 years ago is not a natural process, but the result of historical changes. In other words, a different future is possible if we want to promote a different kind of normal. This sounds very abstract, perhaps. So I've picked one historical example where this was actually done. And this comes from Japan, from the interwar years, where you have something called the Everyday Life Reform, a league of housewives that worked with architects and social reformers with support of the Japanese Ministry of the Interior. And the idea was that the way Japanese lived and consumed in their everyday life needs a radical overhaul to modernize and develop Japan. And so this league promoted a different lifestyle with different appliances, different layout of the interior. And in the poster, you can see in the top right, the present in 1919, so the old Japan that people wanted to get rid of, where the housewife cooks on the floor with charcoal, a lot of fume and pollution. And then in the main picture, you see the new life, the new normal that people should aspire to, with a gas cooker, with electric light, with running water, with the housewife standing and chopping something on the board there. This was part of a whole series, but it did work. And Japanese cities and the home and how people lived in the home was really revolutionized. But it needed the combined effort of consumers, the state, and architects and other experts. So that's my hope for you, that if you are interested in a different future, it is possible, but it needs effort as well as vision. Thank you very much.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.